right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a great show lined up for you today. In fact, at the end of the show, we're going to be talking with the 24th Street Theater, which is a theater group that's located in South Central Los Angeles. And we're going to be talking about both their current play, which is called Walking the Tightrope, as well as the whole philosophy behind the theater group. Really unique, really, really kind of interesting, something you don't want to miss. So you got to stay tuned for that. At the middle segment of the show, we're going to be talking with Andy Worthington. Now, Andy, a lot of people know he's a regular guest on the show. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files and the co-founder of CloseGuantanamo.org. And we're going to be talking with Andy about this hunger strike that's going on at Guantanamo right now, where people, many, at least I think 30 people might be on the edge of a very serious injury or even death, you know. And that's something that we really need to talk about because nobody is paying enough attention to that. And opening the show up, an issue that I think that we've covered a lot in this on this show, this question of stop and frisk, and as it's falling out in New York, playing out in New York. Well, March 18th, as the New York Police Department marked the 5 millionth person, remember that, 5 million people to be stopped under the stop and frisk program since 2004, the case of Floyd versus the City of New York went to trial. The suit was brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights, and it was basically standing up to get racial profiling and stop and frisk declared unconstitutional and a violation of 14th Amendment rights. The trial has exposed a lot of the racist character of this policy, and so much has come out of it. It's just mind-numbing and mind-blowing when you get into this. And joining us to talk about all this is Annette Dickerson, Director of Education and Outreach at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Annette, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, let's just jump into this right away. Let's, you know, as I was saying, the Center for Constitutional Rights brought this suit, and you've charged the NYPD with engaging in racial profiling and suspicionless stop and frisk. Let's start out with some very basic things about stop and frisk. What is it? How frequent? Who? All of that.
Stop and frisk is a policy. It's actually called a stop, question, and frisk. That is the technical term for it. But it is the policy in which the New York Police Department actually stop, question, and frisk New Yorkers, often, most of the time, under dubious circumstances. And it is a practice that at its highest rate, 680,000 people had been stopped in 1 year. And it has just become a regular part of the fabric of many people's lives in New York. It is illegal, it's unconstitutional, and the encounters are more often than not extremely humiliating and degrading.
Well, tell me this. Let's get into some numbers. You know, when you talk about how frequent it is, 600,000 people, was it 2011 that was 600,000?
Yes, okay. 687,000.
Mm-hmm. Now, that means if you really, you know, factor this out, I mean, I spent some time in New York during the summer, and I was up in the Bronx and out in Brownsville, and I'm telling you, you know, person after person not only told me about being stopped for the most mundane reasons and simply really for walking while black, for breathing while black, you know, in a lot of cases, and people telling me that sometimes one guy in the projects in the Bronx said he had been stopped about a dozen times in the last 3 years, you know, and I kept thinking
that, I'm sorry, but Michael, ahead. That is typical of the experience of New Yorkers who are being stopped. When you ask a person, tell me about your experience with stop and frisk, they invariably say, well, which one? Which one are you talking about? And so rather than this being an aberration, this is a constant barrage of humiliation to which New Yorkers are being subjected.
Mm-hmm. And when you say New Yorkers, there's actually specific groupings that are targeted by this. I think it's important because it's connected up with a whole bigger program we'll talk about later. But this actually invariably comes down much, much harder on black and Latino youth, right?
Absolutely. And that is one of the bases for our case. I can give you some numbers on that.
Yes, please do.
In 2012, 87% of the total number of blacks and Latinos, the total number of people stopped were blacks and Latinos, and the percentage of blacks and Latinos in the city of New York is 53 6%. Now, the number, even though the number of stops went down slightly in 2012, the number of blacks went up 2%, from 53% in 2011 to 55% in 2012. And one number that really sticks out, this program is ostensibly an effort to get guns off of the street. When you look at the statistics provided by the NYPD, which we had to sue for, by the way, the weapons confiscation in 2012, guns were seized in a fraction of 1% of the stops. And when you count all the other so-called contraband, it is 1.8%. So you have stopped more than 500,000 people, many of them numerous times, and the stated goal of your rationale for doing it, these are the kind of numbers that you're yielding. So if that is in fact the goal, these numbers say that it is a spectacular failure in addition to being illegal and unconstitutional.
Yeah, it's amazing too, because this is the argument that they push over to sort of like justify stop and frisk, both broadly in society as well as among even people living in the places targeted by this. That, you know, I had young men, for instance, tell me, well, I don't like it, but, you know, sometimes I worry about my grandma being out and walking across the street and getting shot. And so this whole idea, this is sort of the justification that they use for this, to really get across the idea that these are bad neighborhoods, these are bad people, these are people that you've got to clamp down on, and it's all based on solely one thing. The main criterion is race.
And it's the total presumption of criminality among our youth. I should say, even though CCR's lawsuit focuses on the racially discriminatory nature of the practice, there are other populations in the city of New York who are targeted. Members of the LGBT community, youth, homeless population, immigrants. There is a pattern and a similarity about the stories that people share. CCR did a report called Stop and Frisk of the Human Impact, in which we went beyond the Black and Latino youth about which our case has been filed, but interviewed people from other populations, and again the similarities between people's stories are very clear.
Well, you know, tell me one thing. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about this, and this case is the culmination of 15 years of work, more than 15 years of work, by the Center for Constitutional Rights, and that it grew out of the killing of Amadou Diallo in 1999, where the city settled and agreed to submit to stop and frisk information to the CCR, but never did. Talk about that a little bit, this whole history of this.
First of all, I should say I would like to give props to the people in New York City who have been dealing with the issue of police misconduct, police brutality, outside of the courtroom, in their communities for many, many years. And the Daniels case, which was the first case that we filed, the one that you referred to in 1999, was against the Street Crimes Unit, which was the unit that was involved in and responsible for the killing of Amadou Diallo. We filed the case, and as you mentioned, one of the settlements was that they had to give us this data and that they would, you know, not be engaging in racially profiled stops. As we began to look at the data, it became very clear to us that the police department was not abiding by those terms of the settlement. Again, the data that they were providing on these forms called UF-250s. And that is when, in 2004, we decided, I'm sorry, 2007, we decided to file Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
Floyd, I'm sorry.
Okay, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Annette Dickerson, who is the Director of Education and Outreach at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we're talking about the lawsuit that the CCR has recently brought against the NYPD and charging them with violating the Fourth Amendment rights of people and an unconstitutional enforcement of the stop and frisk laws and procedures. Now, Annette, tell me this. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about this Amadou Diallo way back then, you know, and I've been recently just replaying in my mind and actually in my car constantly Wyclef Jean's song Diallo, and the way that that presents this guy in the beginning, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the way it presents Diallo in the beginning, just sort of searching for his keys and turning around, oh, it's, I'm worried these guys are going to rob me. Oh, I better, you know, I'm just going to pull my wallet out so, you know, they only take that. And then he looks and says, oh, it's the police. Whew, I'm going to show them I'm good people. And the next thing is 41 shots. You know, and I kept thinking of that. But in relation to this whole thing, where stop and frisk can actually lead, Kimani Gray. Yeah, let's talk about that a little.
Well, you know, I am. I would like to. When concerning Kimani Gray,
you should tell people who Kimani Gray is.
Kimani Gray is a 16-year-old African American. I would call him a child, as a parent, who was shot and killed by the police in Brooklyn weeks ago, and his killing. Spurred and was the impetus for a lot of deeply held and long-held community rage and anger over the way that communities of color are treated by the police. You know, I am not in a position to speak on, you know, the facts and what the ultimate outcome will be, but I will tell you that these kinds of encounters, the way that the police run up on young people coming out of nowhere, the potential for these kinds of outcomes always exists under those circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
We have, you know, as you know, the entering the third week of the case next week, and the testimony by the plaintiffs.
That's what I want to ask you about. Let's hear about some of the most damning testimony that's come out, because there's been a lot of really revealing testimony.
One of the things that stuck with me most is a testimony of a young man who was stopped when he was 13 years old. He was stopped, and his name is Devin Aliminor, and he was stopped, and they handcuffed him and put him in the back seat of the car. He's 13 years old. And he cried when he testified about it, and he recounted how he was in the back seat of the police car, and he was crying. And the police officer taunted him by saying, "I see you back there crying like a little girl." And I should say that the police officer, you know, on the witness stand, did admit to taunting this 13-year-old child. There have been more than one of the plaintiffs who have been teary-eyed when they talk about their testimony. One young man, Nicholas Peart, who is the sole guardian of his three young siblings since his mother died, was stopped going into his building with his own keys, and he was afraid because we know what can happen in a loaded moment when we're talking about cops. He was afraid for his younger siblings who were alone in the apartment, not knowing what the police might do and unable to protect them in that moment. And so, you know, and again, these are young people who have been stopped over and over and over again.
It creates an atmosphere of absolute terror in the neighborhoods,
yes.
I think. You know, it's just really, really important to understand. And, you know, one of the things, you know, I was thinking about in terms of people not understanding some things like that, how systematic this is, because some of the testimony that has come out by the cops has also been revealing. The idea that they're told, they are specifically instructed to go after Black and Latino males.
Absolutely. It is numbers driven, and the police officers are under, and it proves that this is a top-to-bottom problem. There are people who would like to spin this with the bad egg paradigm. But we know from the testimony of whistleblowers and from the testimony of officers that we have spoken to as hostile witnesses that there is explicit direction to those police officers to go out there and to get those numbers. They want the numbers at all costs. And a lot of this is what is driving this, you know, these numbers to go up, and not insignificantly, the implicit and sometimes explicit racism that is behind these stops.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of, you know, well, let me first remind listeners again that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Annette Dickerson, who is the Director of Education and Outreach at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and we're talking about the suit they recently brought against the City of New York around their stop and frisk policy. Annette, tell me this, you know, because we're talking about all this, and there's this point about, as we were just talking about, creating this sense of terror. And actually, one of the things, I remember the New York Times last summer did a piece on how often physical force and intimidation and assault is used when these stop and frisk things are done, you know, and particularly in certain neighborhoods in the West Bronx and Brownsville, places like that, where physical force is used against guys and sexual assault against young women.
Yes, that is also borne out by what we are told. Now, in the data that we get from the police department, the UF-250 is a checkoff form that on which the officer is to check off the reason for the stop. And I should say that the category that is most often checked out is this vague category called furtive movements, which could mean anything, as we know. But there is a category in which the officer can indicate whether there was any physical force used. And in almost all of the cases, that physical force most of the time means that they take someone, they turn them around, and they throw them up against the wall. They make them empty their pockets. They make them show their papers, you know, as if this was, you know, Johannesburg in the 1960s. And you know, if there is the slightest bit of reaction to that, then a person finds themselves arrested for resisting arrest. Although I should say that, again, for 2012, all of those people who were stopped, only 6% resulted in an arrest. So you are handled roughly. In many cases, you are handled inappropriately, sexually inappropriately, and you are expected, you know, after all of that, to just go on your merry way and have a lovely day.
Mm-hmm. Now, Annette, we have time for one more question, and it's a very important one, because this is not happening, you know, sort of in its own right. It's not happening just sort of isolated off from everything else. It's part of a much bigger program, I think. And in particular, I want to talk to you about this program that many people have spoken about, the pipeline to prison, the new Jim Crow, the connection to the mass incarceration, where you've gone from how many times is it quadrupled or eight times, whatever, you know, where you now have gone to more than 2.4 million people in jail, more than half of them Black and Latino, you know, and yeah. What connection does this whole program of stop and frisk have to do with that kind of ultimately slow genocidal program?
It potentially further criminalizes and provides a gateway into the criminal injustice system that we have. The beast has to be fed. And any means by which the beast is fed, whether it's through these policies that can catch our youth and get them in, whether it's through, you know, Rockefeller drug law type policies, the immigration detention has exploded, jail construction, prison construction is going up, and so the stop and frisk is a point of entry through which our young people are entering the criminal justice system.
Absolutely. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And Annette, we're going to have you back as the case goes on. I know you expect it to be going on for at least a couple more weeks, right?
I do. And I'd like to say that we are providing daily updates.
Okay, where?
Of what occurs each day. And those updates can be found at ccrjustice.org.
All right, Annette, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. Bye. All right, we're going to, before we go into our next segment, I just want to read you something. And this is something that appeared in Revolution newspaper, and it's on the NYPD's 5 millionth stop and frisk. A question. If any country on earth pick one, had its armed enforcers swarm on people simply walking down the street, stop them, search them, often threaten, insult, and humiliate them. And if the rulers of this country persisted in this policy, even though stopping people and searching them without any probable cause and without any indication that they are breaking a law blatantly violated its own constitution, and if the ruling powers of this country had their police do this, despite the fact that 90% of the time, even under their own repressive laws, the victims of this stop-and-frisk policy violated no law, and if the people singled out to be stopped, humiliated, threatened, and sometimes worse, brutalized and killed, were nationalities who had historically been viciously exploited by the rulers of this country, even literally enslaved for over 200 years, and if victims of stop-and-frisk were stigmatized, criminalized, and set on a track to end up in prisons, and if the rulers of this particular country did this 5 million times in a single city, you would say that is an illegitimate regime, one with no right to rule. So, what does that tell you about the rulers of the USA? We've been talking with Annette Dickerson from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we've been talking about the Center's lawsuit against the NYPD for their stop and frisk policy. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Andy Worthington to talk about the hunger strike at Guantanamo Prison. Welcome back. That's Ry Cooter with Guantanamo. You can't come home from Guantanamo. A perfect song for our next segment. Joining us now is Andy Worthington. Andy's been on the show a number of times, always providing a very insightful and deep understanding of what the hell is going on with the Guantanamo torture chamber. And now, Andy, who is the author of The Guantanamo Files, the co-founder of CloseGuantanamo.org, and he's one of the leading experts in the world on the human rights abuses at Guantanamo, he's joining us to talk about what has recently developed since the beginning of February, a hunger strike by the prisoners at Guantanamo. Andy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Michael. It's good to be talking to you again.
You too, man. Now, you're not in Sherwood Forest, right?
No.
Okay, all right. Let's just be careful about that. All right. And for people who don't know, it was just we had some trouble one time a long time ago where we got lost in the forest and couldn't continue our conversation. Won't happen now. So, Andy, what's going on with Guantanamo, with the hunger strike? Explain to people what's happening, how extensive it is, whatnot, all the things, basic things we need to know to get into a conversation around this.
Sure. Well, it sounds like it's very extensive, Michael, but it started, from what we understand, in the first week of February. The prisoners reported through their lawyers that the guard force were behaving in an aggressive manner, the likes of which they hadn't seen since the bad old days of George W. Bush. That they were confiscating personal items, some of their private mail between themselves and their attorneys, and they were also mishandling the Quran. Now, that's a pretty sure way to upset the prisoners. But also, you know, what underlies all of this is the despair that many of these men are feeling after over 11 years of the prison being open, and, of course, with so many of them having been told many years ago that they were going to be released. That's over half of the 166 men, 86 of them, having been told that the United States had no desire to hold them forever. 3 or 4 years ago, they were all told that. So, you know, it's easy to understand why prisoners would be upset. Now, the story, you know, first came out, as I say, through attorneys reporting it, and we had blanket denials from the Obama administration and the military for, I would say, actually, pretty much the first month. They were saying, no, the only people that are on a hunger strike are the 5 or 6 people that have been on a hunger strike for a very long time. One of these guys has been on a hunger strike for nearly 8 years. But they said, no, there's no one else on a hunger strike. And what I think happened, Michael, is that, you know, the media picked up on the story more and more, and it became untenable for them to carry on lying. So they started accepting that, yes, there were a small number of people on a hunger strike. And, you know, I think about a week and a half ago it was 14, and the numbers have steadily been going up, so that you know, this week the latest I heard was that 31 men are now on a hunger strike. Now, that's still far from what the lawyers are saying, reporting what the prisoners are saying, which is that it's a majority of the prisoners in Camp 6, the biggest block in Guantanamo, where most of the prisoners are held, that it's a majority of those men, and there are 130 men out of the 166 still held in that particular block.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, it's you know, when you're talking about that, I keep thinking about this thing of the lawyers and the role that the lawyers played in this. I read the letter that they sent to Hagel, the Secretary of Defense in this country, you know, and it was very moving and very powerful, where they basically just called them out and said, look, this is what's going on, and you have not answered us at all. These lawyers are playing, and even when you're saying that, you know, a lot of the things that we know about the impact of the hunger strike, about the extent of the hunger strike, the what's happening to the prisoners themselves health-wise, what we know has actually come from a lot of these lawyers deciding they're going to stand up, to hell with it. I'm going to stand up with it. Defending my client actually means, in this case, standing up and revealing what the hell's going on and what's happening to these guys. I thought that was very, very heavy in this case.
Well, I think, to be honest, you know, a lot of the lawyers have seen their prisoners, their clients on hunger strike before, because there have been many throughout the prison's history. But, you know, certainly, you know, the thing driving this is that lawyers went down to Guantanamo to meet with their clients as usual. And some of them came back saying there's a huge hunger strike going on. I've just seen my client. He has lost, you know, a shocking amount of weight. What we're seeing is prisoners losing between 20 and 30 pounds in weight. Now, if you, you know, ignore the propaganda that comes out from the Republicans about how everybody at Guantanamo is well-fed and, you know, and fatter than the average, you know, which is for the most part a lie. There are a few overweight prisoners there, but the majority of the prisoners are not. They are starting from a point that is thinner than what we used to in everyday life. So when people are losing 20 to 30 pounds on top of that, we're ending up with people that are looking skeletal. They're looking like people with extreme anorexia. You know, that's deeply shocking. And I've heard the reports from the lawyers who've seen their clients in this state recently, and you can tell they're deeply moved as human beings to see these people that they represent, you know, withering away. You know, I imagine that it's profoundly shocking.
Well, plus there's really an aspect of this that, you know, both the profound shock of that, but then also there's, you know, you can't be on a hunger strike. You can't not eat for an unlimited amount of time. You actually, your body begins to reach, to deteriorate rapidly, not just losing weight, but you actually reach a point where at some point, you are in much greater danger of dying, you know, where it's, and some of it is irreversible in terms of the mental damage and the physical damage.
Yeah.
And this is heavy things. And we're talking about, they've been on here for almost 8 weeks now?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, Michael, they've got experience of force feeding prisoners at Guantanamo to make sure that they don't die. You know, one of these men, like I say, has been on the hunger strike since 2005. That means that every day since the summer of 2005, he has been strapped into a restraint chair twice a day and has had a tube stuffed up his nose and into his stomach and has been force-fed the liquid supplement that will keep him alive every day for this shocking amount of time. I'm not sure that there is a recorded instance in modern history of somebody being force-fed that long by whatever government, whether they claim to be you know, a government that respects the rule of law and the rights of human beings or not. It's absolutely disgraceful. But they have learned as a result of that they can keep people alive by force-feeding them for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking with Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files, co-founder of CloseGuantanamo.org, and we're speaking about the hunger strike at Guantanamo Prison. Now, Andy, what you just said has me sitting here with my mouth open. You know, I hadn't even conceived of somebody being on a hunger strike for 7 years, going on 8 years, and being force-fed twice a day, every day. That, and force-feeding is an extremely painful, even qualifies in some places as torture. This is an extremely just outrageous example that you've put up. And I wonder how you know, common that is. And then also I kept thinking about the thing of, you know, the other ways that the system, that the authorities there are trying to break this strike. You know, and just recently there's been a report that they've denied the hunger strikers even water, you know, clean water. And they've denied that, and they also turned the air conditioner up, so they're freezing in their cells. Let's talk about those things of repression that have been going on.
Well, you know, I would say that within the prison itself, the authorities, you know, are caught up in a, if you like, a potentially endless struggle with the prisoners. So, you know, actually running the prison humanely is probably a better way to make sure that the prisoners, you know, give you less trouble. But, you know, all of this is within the particular context of the prison itself. The bigger picture is the one that actually bothers me more than that, because the logic or lack of it of how you actually run a prison and how you impose discipline, etc., I can see that it has, you know, it has rules of its own. The fact is that you know, the entire place is run by the United States government. The man who is answerable to what happens there is the President of the United States. The other group of people who are particularly responsible for what happens there is the United States Congress. And, you know, and they are the people who are not dealing with the emergency that is arising at Guantanamo, which is entirely their fault that these men are in such despair, because the president promised to close Guantanamo, and he has failed to do so. He has partly been stopped in doing so by Congress, but he has partly stopped himself from doing it. He's imposed this completely unjustifiable ban for the last 3 years on releasing any Yemenis from the prison who have been cleared for release by the task force that he established to decide who should leave Guantanamo. So the task force said that all of these Yemenis should be able to leave Guantanamo. The United States didn't want to hold them. Then a Nigerian man tried to blow up a plane with a bomb in his underwear and failed, and he was recruited in Yemen. There was a backlash, and the president said, fine, we're not going to release anyone to Yemen from Guantanamo. And these guys are sitting there. It's 3 years now. As far as I understand, the president is happy for these men to die in Guantanamo, whenever it is, maybe decades from now, because it's because of this ban that he put in place on releasing any Yemenis, even though they had been cleared by the task force that he had established. You know, how absurd can we get that you set processes in place to review prisoners' cases and then you ignore the results of them? These guys were better off if nobody had ever told them anything.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Andy Worthington, journalist, filmmaker, and one of the co-founders of the CloseGuantanamo.org site. And we're talking about the hunger strike being waged by prisoners at the Guantanamo prison camp. Well, you know, there's another thing, Andy, that comes into play here, too, because, and you've mentioned this in some of the things you've written, you know, there's a, you know, Obama still, or his spokespeople still mutter every now and then that, well, we fully intend to close Guantanamo. But some things recently have happened that indicate what's really going on. If you look at the things like, you know, they shut down the office of the special envoy for the closure of Guantanamo, not something you would do if you were actually, you know, looking to close it. And then the other thing that really blew my mind is this massive amount of money, including $50 million this massive amount of money has been allocated for, you know, upgrading Guantanamo, including building new quarters for special high-level detainees, i.e. Sure. the Guantanamo prisoners. Doesn't sound like what you do if you were planning on moving out.
No, well, it certainly isn't. And, I mean, you know, you see, the administration could argue, Michael, that they're responding to this difficult situation they found themselves in where, you know, they're blaming it all on Congress, even though, as I say, President Obama bears a huge responsibility himself. But, you know, clearly it's not possible to close the prison in any short amount of time, even if the will was there. So they do have, you know, aging facilities there that need to be upgraded. I can understand that. Now, obviously, the message it sends is this prison is going to be here forever. You know, we could argue and say, well, please don't get that thought in place, because, you know, I understand that you need to upgrade things at least for now, but don't try and make it look like it's forever. But, you know, what I would like people to pay attention to more, and I haven't seen this reported and I've been writing about it myself, is the amount of money that is being spent on holding prisoners that the United States government says it doesn't want to hold. These are the cleared prisoners. Now, we already know from statistics that were released about the costs about 16 months ago that it costs around $70 million a year to keep holding men at Guantanamo that the task force cleared for release, but that President Obama then said he wanted to carry on holding, or the men who can't be released because it's just proving inconvenient and Congress is getting in the way. These men that the government doesn't want to hold, 70 million a year. Now, you know, they're spending 200 million on doing up Guantanamo, and 50 million of that is for the prison for the, actually for the high value detainees, Michael. So these are the 16 high value detainees. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the other men allegedly responsible for 9/11, and all these other poor guys who spent years in CIA black sites being tortured. That's 50 million for their special prison. 150 million then is for running the rest of the prison and doing that up. Half the cleared prisoners, half the men in Guantanamo are cleared prisoners. So let's say half of that amount. It's another 70 million. This year alone, it is going to cost the United States around $150 million to hold men that the United States government doesn't want to hold. Who at any point is going to be made answerable, not only for the monstrous mockery of justice of saying to people that you want to release them and then not releasing them, but also the eye-wateringly huge amounts of money that it's costing? It's absurd. It really is just disgraceful.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I think actually, when you think about it, yes, I think, you know, you hold responsible this system, the you know, its government, all this other stuff. But then also we have to actually speak to the people who are not responding in a way that's commensurate enough to the horrible injustice that's going on. And I wanted to say something. We have about five more minutes, and I wanted you to speak to two questions. And one is, you described, in speaking about what's going on in Guantanamo and the situation that the prisoners there face, you described that as living in a tomb. And then later, a little while ago, there was a lawyer, Carlos Warner, got a message from his client, Faiz Al-Kandari, which said, and I want to read people this because it's very, very heavy. It said, "I scare myself when I look in the mirror. Let them kill us as we have nothing to lose. We died when Obama indefinitely detained us. Respect us or kill us. It is your choice. The U.S. must take off its mask and kill us." Let's talk about those things.
Well, you know, that's a real cry of despair from Guantanamo. I mean, briefly, I know about Fires' case. Fires is one of the last two Q80s in Guantanamo. He is one of 46 men officially designated for indefinite detention without charge or trial at Guantanamo by President Obama. His task force, when they went through the prisoners' cases, they said, look, there are 48 guys, too dangerous to hold, but we don't have the evidence to put them on trial. Now, that means it's not evidence. That means it's an untrustworthy collection of dubious reports and hearsay and statements made by other prisoners. It's very fundamentally important to recognize that there is not necessarily any basis for trusting the government when they say these guys are too dangerous, but we can't prove it. But anyway, Fires is one of these guys. Now, I've studied his case in detail. The government doesn't actually have a case against him at all, but he is in this category of prisoner who they want to hold forever. The real insult added to this is that when President Obama issued an executive order authorizing the indefinite detention of Fires and these 47 other men 2 years ago, he said there will be periodic reviews of their cases to check that it's fair that we carry on holding them, that they still constitute a threat. He has done nothing to establish those reviews. He has said that he would do that, and then he has thrown these guys in a dungeon and thrown away the key. So no wonder Fires is so upset. No wonder these other men, you know, they are as unjustly treated as the men who were told that they were cleared for release but are still held. There is almost nobody in that prison that hasn't been treated with the utmost contempt and disdain by every branch of the United States government, right up to the President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy, on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up, and I look forward to talking with you again very soon.
Thank you very much, Michael.
All right. Take care, man. Talk to
you.
Bye. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Andy Worthington, author of Guantanamo Files, and one of the co-founders of CloseGuantanamo.org. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by three people from the 24th Street Theater and talking about not just their new play, the play that they're running there, Walking the Tightrope, but also the whole theater and the philosophy behind it. It's something I found really compelling and intriguing. So let's take a quick break and be right back. ¶¶ All right, now, I defy anybody who's out there listening to tell me that they are not sitting there with a big, big grin on their face right now, all right? If you aren't sitting there with a grin, there's something seriously wrong with you, okay? And this is the way I get out of lots of spats with my family, my dogs, everybody else. I just put the song on and everybody gets happy and marches around, okay? So, welcome back. Joining us now to talk about their play, Walking the Tightrope, and actually the theater and the whole concept of the theater itself, the 24th Street Theater. Joining us is Debbie Devine, the director, and Jay McAdams, the executive director, and Cindy Marie Jenkins, the marketing director of the theater. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having us.
Here.
Okay. Did you just hand me this for a reason?
I was just showing you our season brochure.
Oh, okay.
Because look at the tagline on that. Does that look like what you'd think? Because you saw the show. Does that look like what you would think the tagline would be for a children's show?
No.
No. It's provocative, right?
Well, yes. And let's talk about this. The play is Walking the Tightrope, okay? It's a really, just really compelling, really enjoyable, but really compelling. And you walk out of there thinking, damn, what did I just, you know, there's something that happens there that was really, really intriguing. So let's talk
about that a little.
Tell people what the play is about. And since Debbie, since you're the director, we'll start with you. Tell people what the play is about.
Well, very simply, it's about a grandfather and his granddaughter and the loss of the grandmother. And a little girl named Esme comes to the – we're setting it in England. It's 1959 in a seaside coast in England. And the little girl comes to visit her grandparents every year right at the end of summer. And this year, Nana, or the grandmother, is not there. And so it's her discovering what has happened to the grandmother and the grandfather trying to reconcile his heart and soul to the loss of his beloved spouse.
Well, there's some things that happen in this, though, that I actually really – they kind of knocked me back because – and in reading about it, you got a play – that was a lot of lines of poetic 20, narrative.
26 pages of verse.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly.
For two characters.
With no stage instructions.
Correct.
With no way, no breaking it up. And you had to actually figure out how to do that. And you actually had to, you were actually almost compelled to take many liberties with the play while striving to keep the core of it true.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But the core of it, that source material, was so powerful. I mean, it is really the taboo in family theater is that you don't deal with death. So it's the first thing we ran to for the launch of our season is death. But this is, as you saw, and I thank you so much for coming, the verse is so beautiful and so delicate that we knew that it was going to – children were going to be able to handle it, and adults have experienced it in a really powerful way, unexpected for us. We knew that they would embrace it, but we didn't realize the depth in which people – seeing this and feeling their own relationship with their loved ones would be met with such tenderness. I mean, they don't leave at the end of the show. We've never had that. We've been at the theater for 15 years. We're celebrating our quinceañera. And people do not leave. They applaud and sit in the house. And that's the biggest tribute we've ever had.
And the night I was there, there were so many kids there and talking back during the thing and everything else. And you could see they were really engaged with it. It really made – it had an impact on them. And
on a different level than it did on you, though, yes.
Yeah, well, maybe. And that's, you don't know.
But, well, that's the mystery and magic of it.
Right. You don't know how childish I can be. Talk to many people, all right?
Oh, that's great.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with members of the L.A.-based 24th Street Theater about their current play, Walking the Tightrope, and the really unique philosophy behind the theater company itself. Jay, tell me this. Let's talk about the purpose of the theater, because I want to talk a little bit more about it, including the fact that you added a clown,
right,
you know, character in this, which was really deep, and especially because it represents the dead relative, the grandmother. But it's so deep and so amazingly done. And I wanted to actually – this whole idea of how to structure this and the kind of theater that you would do. I mean, we live in a world and it's been mentioned in a couple places. We live in a world where you had Sandy Hook, where you have – and I think you might have said or you might have said – somebody might have said – somebody did say that, you know, we also live in a world where so many hundreds of millions of kids are living utter horror.
Yeah.
You know, you think about 10 million people a year – 10 million kids a year around the world die of preventable diseases.
Absolutely.
And so we have these kids living in a situation, and yet everything we present to them in stories and plays and things like that is all this happy face, bunnies going or hopping down a trail and all this stuff.
Right.
But you guys have figured out a way to take this to a different level, to take the how kids are dealing with reality to a different level and still keep it something that's both accessible and meaningful to adults, but also at the same time really reaches to the kids too. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, we're walking the tightrope, literally, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we are. But, you know, it's kind of like what you do. It's kind of like what you do here because, you know, you're dealing. I mean, I love that we're on a show where you're talking about the stop and frisk stuff in Guantanamo Bay and then kids theater. Because how unusual is that? That's really weird. not your norm. And for us, we're kind of in that same boat. We're, you know, our goal is to talk substance to people because as you get older, you have no time for plays. You know, just, oh, this is a sweet little play. Who cares? You know, when you're 15th year, you got to get on with it. You know what I mean? And so for us, it is about taking if a play doesn't have powerful messages behind it, why spend the time and money that it takes to do a play and the energy?
And it's 57 minutes. We tell mm-hmm. this story in 57 minutes. You can tell a powerful story in that short amount of time.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that funny, you know, funny bunny hat children's theater out there. So our thing in doing children's theater is, look, if we're going to do it, we're going to be the kind of the red cat for those of you in LA, you know, who know kind of performance art and great art. We're the Red Cat Junior, you know. We're children's theater that matters, and that's been our, you know, kind of our whole purpose.
But I think what we've done is we've actually created children's theater for adults. I think that's what the
right.
show has become.
Well, and that's always been our goal. You know, our goal has always been to do adult theater for children or children's theater for adults, whatever you call it. But in that, really, it's timeless, ageless theater that's just good rockin' theater, no matter how old you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not done very often.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Debbie Devine, director of the play Walking the Tightrope, Jay McAdams, executive director of the theater, and Cindy Marie Jenkins, marketing director of the 24th Street Theater. Cindy, let me ask you.
Yes.
See, you thought you were sitting way over in the corner. I can see that far.
Thank you, Head.
Yeah, but you got to speak into the microphone.
Okay, here I am.
You know, what's your take on all this? You know, it's because you're marketing director, and actually this – you know, it's got to be a little bit of a bear when you set out to, because people don't expect this. I had a friend who was watching this, and he knows I'm a revolutionary and all this, and he says, "Are you going to have this on your show?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Hey, this isn't taking Tiger Mountain by strategy." And I said, "Yeah, but it's like this human, really unique approach to a human experience that I wanted to explore." You know, and so how do you deal with this? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I've come from a unique position where I've been going to the theater with my parents since I was five. It was actually really exciting when they came to visit. I could bring them to our first show of the season because they've never been afraid to expose us to any sort of story because we could talk about it after. And I was so excited when they asked me to join the team. And then I've had such positive responses from parents, from people who aren't parents, and because they don't have something they can go see together. They don't have this experience. And one of my favorite things is getting an email or Facebook message a day or two after the show saying, you know, we're still talking about it. One of the, whether they're new people to the theater or one of our regular mothers with her son said, you know, they were setting it in different time periods and talking about how it would change the story and what might be different and what design choices they might make differently. And, you know, he's 7 or 8, I think. And
wow.
I just love that. And the fact that the story really lives on and keeps people talking to each other and surprises parents a lot with what their children comprehend and how they process it and then want to talk about it. So mm-hmm. it's been, for me, it's been so much fun just to talk to people before and after and then, you know, days or weeks later about it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with members of the L.A.-based 24th Street Theater about their current play, Walking the Tightrope, and the really unique philosophy behind the theater company itself. Debbie, tell me this. When you were conceiving of this and how you would stage it, you know, the idea that you had this, as everybody's saying, you have this, you have an adult story, a children's story for adults, but you also have an adult story for children.
Right.
And it's very, you've combined this and in such a short period of time. I mean, I could see myself wrestling with that in 97 pages down the line, like, oh God, I got to start all over, you know, but there's a point that you have here of where you and really, I mean, one of the things that really struck me, I mean, I was in tears a lot of the time in the middle of the thing, and it's because you're looking at the
old man. The ticket prices, right?
No, and it wasn't the food offered. You had me with the tamales in the beginning, okay? Right. For free? How can you beat that?
Yeah, exactly. Those are made in the neighborhood.
Right. I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. Let's talk about this, though. Just this idea that you had this one very gripping story of the older man and his whole lifetime spent with his lover, as I think you put in the writing about it. You have a spouse who dies, the surviving one is faced with the idea of this is the person that you've loved for so long, that you slept with every night, that you woke up with every morning, and they're gone. And you had the way you staged it, the way you put that out there was so gripping. And at the same time, he's got to deal with somehow his granddaughter, who's also coming at this thing of, my Nana's missing, you know, where is she, you know? And it was just a remarkable piece. I can't say enough about it.
I really love that you got that. So what it is, it's 26 pages of verse. If you read the verse, you'll understand it's written by Mike Kenney, who's a theater for young audiences author. And you read the verse and you will understand that it is her story. It's the story of a little, you know, as it's been done before. It's a story of a little girl and wanting to understand what happened to her grandmother. We did exactly what you just described. We said, let's not make it about the little girl. Let's make the story about the grandfather. And once we switched that point of view, it was his heartache, his pain, the depth of his loss, and how he was concealing it from her because he couldn't face it himself. It suddenly worked for us. And then we have this rockin' fabulous team. It's live music. It's beautiful media from Matt Hill. It's fabulous design work from Keith Mitchell. I mean, it's a great collaborative team that we've worked with before and love and appreciate. And we have shorthand together, you know.
Yeah, and I have to say, I really loved the set. It was just remarable.
And these are the same the same designers, the same artists that we use in our adult stuff.
Right. No B team for family theater.
Okay, well, let's talk about this. Lab 24.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what that is. And then also, because we only have about maybe 3 minutes left, I want you to also, in that short period of time, talk a little bit about your relation to the neighborhood. Because that was the first time I was at the theater, even though I've always intended to be there. Mm-hmm. And I looked and I saw 24 cents. I'm moving to North University Park. They charge 24 cents for residents of North University Park. Do you have to show an ID?
No,
you don't.
No, you do not.
And they trust you. How
Absolutely.
Can you beat that?
Okay.
So. Well, we don't want people to be embarrassed or have to, you know. We make it easy. But we're very uniquely tied to the neighborhood because when we first, you know, we're building the theater 15 years ago, kids in the neighborhood started to come by and say, "What are you doing? You know, what are you building?" And we realized in talking to them, they didn't even know what a theater was. They'd never even seen a play. They didn't understand the concept even of theater. And we realized, wait a minute, we're now no longer on the West Side. We're in the inner city doing theater, and we could really make a difference here. So our mission kind of changed early on to become about really impacting the neighborhood, not about doing plays, which is what most theaters, you know, do. So, I mean, we do plays, but it's really got to be about making a difference. It's about who sees the plays. You know, if we do great art, the best art in the city, that's great. But what if none of the people around us are seeing it?
Right, right.
You know, what good does it do? So that's where the tamales came from.
We have a huge arts education program. We have an after-school program called After Cool, because it's just too cool to be after school.
75 inner-city kids every week for
Absolutely.
30 weeks
we
a year.
We do residencies, work with teachers. It's a big part of our mission.
We do teacher training. We do a lot more than just plays, so that's kind of our basic mission.
And they see the plays.
Yeah.
Right.
And then they see the plays.
This is great. Actually, you know what I need to do? I need to come down there sometime and just
hang out.
We'd love it.
Hang out and maybe even record some of what goes on.
Hey, there's lots of revolutionary stuff going on there. You'll feel right at home.
Okay, well, good.
See, Enter Stage Right.
That's our field trip program.
I thought you were telling me Enter Stage Right, and I said, no!
I'm left!
We should change that, the field trip program, to Enter Stage Left.
It's Enter Stage Left.
Let me just emphasize one more time what you're going to get from the 24th Street Theater and theater companies like this. And I hope that this theater company is acting like a template for theater companies all over the country and all over the world. I certainly hope they are, and people everywhere will get a chance to see it. But for people who may not get a chance to see it right now, I just want you to know that this was one of the most unique and important theatrical experiences I think I've ever had. It's something that I was just really stunned by. I have to tell you, I was really and that's in all sincerity, all joking aside, it was that really moved me a lot.
You know, thank you.
To be there and to hear your rap at the beginning, to see the play, to see the people that were coming in. In fact, as I was standing there waiting for my tickets, the family from the neighborhood came in.
Great.
And
oh,
it was
wonderful.
And I was watching this, all these little kids and stuff, and they're putting out their quarters to get in, right?
Yes,
and
yes.
It was great.
Right.
It was really
and they
great.
Get change back.
There you go.
But then they donate it, so we're building philanthropy, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
It's a remarkable experience, folks. I'm telling you, it's really remarkable. We've been talking with the members of the L.A.-based 24th Street Theater about their current play, Walking the Tightrope, and the really unique philosophy they have in the theater company. And on that note, we've reached the end of yet another show. And I want to thank all of my guests today, Annette Dickerson from the Center for Constitutional Rights, author, filmmaker, and activist Andy Worthington, and the L.A.-based 24th Street Theater. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. You know, I was thinking about Annette Dickerson comparing the stop and frisk operation in New York City to Johannesburg back in 1980s apartheid South Africa. Plus, I realized that the late Gil Scott-Heron's birthday was April 1st. So I thought, what better song to go out with than Johannesburg from Gil Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson. Talk to you again next week. Yes, I